Right, time for our Friday interview. Coming out as gay in the macho world of rugby union. Huge decision to take. That's what the Welsh... Excuse me, I've got the hiccups now. That's what the Welsh... rugby legend Gareth Thomas did. It led to him being the first openly gay player in the world. This is a fascinating story, and now Hollywood is calling, with the actor Mickey Rourke scripting a film based on Gareth's life. I've been speaking to Gareth about why he decided to tell his story, and we started by talking about what he was like as a little boy growing up in Wales with dreams of becoming a rugby star.
I just felt like a dream better and be more of a hero on the rugby field than anywhere else.
And were you literally dreaming about being a sports superstar?
Yeah, you know, yeah. At every sport I played, you know, I lived in a street where, you know, we had a little green area on the street, and you know, in the summer it would become the Wimbledon tennis courts. When World Cup football was on, it'd become the World Cup stadium or the rugby stadium. So, you know, all of us, we all created, like children do, you know, whatever's on at the time, whatever sport is relevant at the time, then, you know, that was what we'd all wanted to be great at.
It's lovely, Gareth, isn't it? When you think back to your childhood, if you're anything like me, there's just that, I don't know, there's that innocent enthusiasm where somehow you think you don't stop yourself being so madly, crazily ambitious.
Yeah, and I think sometimes...
It's,
you know,
lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think sometimes it's sad that sensibility, you know, people who are really sensible, and when you mature and grow older, that you lose that kind of inner child. And I think that's quite sad, because I think even to dream it for a second is a fantastic feeling. And, you know, we did. I, you know, everybody, it wasn't just me in the street or me in the school. Everybody dreamt of, you know, being the greatest at sporting events or at certain things at some time growing up. And, you know, I don't know if it was an escape from reality, but I think it was just a childhood thing to do that. Unfortunately, when you grow up, you lose that kind of ability to be able to daydream and to kind of let yourself go away.
So at what age did you realise that you were very, very good at rugby?
It was when I felt I could hear people kind of saying, oh, this guy could be good, or this guy has got a certain ability. And
then when you did realise you were good, is that when, you know, those dreams could all of a sudden, for the chosen few, and you were one of them, there's the potential for it to be a reality?
Yeah, but I think that's when it gets a little bit scary, actually, when it's a potential of becoming a reality, because, you know, when you dream, you can wake up, but when it becomes a reality, then that's it. It's kind of there for good. So
yeah, but when you get the first call up, for example, to play for Wales,
yeah,
play for your country,
yeah,
did you enjoy it or did you feel the pressure?
My difference was my call up for the first time to play for Wales was came in a letter form, and it was to go to a World Cup. So, you know, I was part of a squad that was going to the World Cup, and, you know, I remember my father, we were both working in the post office at the time, and my father brought the letter around because he'd been to collect our mail that day, and I was working and I was standing by my feet, and he brought the letter around with a little Welsh Rugby Union badge on it, and he stood there like a Cheshire cat, grinning, praying for me to open it in front of him. And, you know, I opened it and I read it out, and for me, the joy came in what I saw in my father's
face.
What
does the letter actually say? Is it worded nicely or matter-of-factly?
Yeah, no, it was just kind of, you know, you've been selected to be part of the World Cup squad to go to South Africa in 1985, and, you know, we'd like you to attend these training sessions, and there's a list of dates at these places at these times. And like I said, for me, the enjoyment came when I saw, you know, when I read it to my father and I saw what it meant to my father, and then realising what it'd mean to my family.
And throughout all of this, as has been very well publicised, widely publicised and talked about, you mentioned about you being a person, and of course, you're harbouring a secret.
Yeah.
And the secret is your sexuality, and you're in this... Well, does it get more macho than the rugby field and the dressing room and that complete testosterone filled world? And you're hiding who you are.
I was carrying a secret with me, a secret that was, like, I suppose, slowly killing me, but, you know, also a secret that was, you know, chipping away at me and affecting me. And, you know, rugby in one way was the best thing in my life, because it gave me a channel of being able to kind of vent my anger, and something where, and a place where actually I felt like I belonged, which was on the rugby field.
You say it was slowly killing you.
You know, I feel like lies just chip away, and if you're a decent person, which, you know, I like to think, you know, I am, and is that every day when you lie to somebody, you know, you wake up to somebody every morning and you look them in the eye and you lie to them, or you go to training, which is a very team-oriented game, and, you know, within a good team, then there's honesty and truth, yet within that you're lying, or even with your family, where again you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't be lying, then you do that. And I think anyone who's decent, when they do that every day, then it chips away at them, and it slowly kills them.
Can you describe the feeling inside you of what the pressure felt like of hiding?
Well, to me, it was, I kind of created like a split personality and a dual character to be able to deal with it, because I needed to justify the reason why I was lying. And if I could justify I was lying because it wasn't actually me, it was kind of this darker side, this darker character, then for me, I could deal with it. I could deal with it that way.
What do you mean? I'm not sure what you mean. So just split personality. So you were different to different people.
Yeah, well, you know, because
I felt I was
the rugby player, and yeah, the public perception and what the public saw and what the rugby playing crowd saw, and what I wanted everybody, kind of who I thought stereotypically should know who I am, and I should be like who they think I am, then I would be the rugby playing person as far as they were concerned. And then, you know, if I went to London, or if I was going places on my own, then I would kind of invent myself to be somebody else, because I couldn't be that same person and still be able to carry on lying, because that would have been too much for me. So I did literally create, as far as I was concerned, a separate character. Therefore, I could almost justify why I would lie.
Separate character?
Yeah, yeah. It was kind of like, I called it like the Gareth and the Alfie. And the one, you know, the one persona was the rugby person that everybody saw. And then the secret hiding life was the other character.
So that's bound to screw you up, isn't it?
I have no doubt if a psychologist got hold of me at, probably even at now, he'd say I'm messed up. But back then, I'm sure he would have put me right in a straitjacket and locked every door in the room, because I have no doubt that there was a lot going wrong with me. But it was my way of coping.
And what were you doing, Gareth? Like, were you trying to get away? I don't know, outside of the country, outside of places that where your friends were familiar, so that you could, you know, I don't know, go into gay clubs, meet gay people, go out with men.
Yeah, well, I'd go to, you know, it was very rare, because for me, I used the rugby. So if you went to London with the rugby, then you'd stay away. Or, you know, if we went abroad, really, then you had the opportunity to go away, and I'd go to maybe a gay bar in London. And I just kind of, I think it's just kind of, again, like a lot of people feel, it's just realizing that there are other people out there that feel the same as you, that you're not the only one going through this kind of crisis. So,
but how were you handling in your head the enormous risk? You know, maybe you were wanting to be caught, is probably what a psychologist would say. But you know, if you're going into a gay bar in London, you might as well put a big banner in your back.
Yeah, but you
don't worry about the newspapers.
You know, social media was nowhere near as relevant. You know, telephone cameras were nowhere near as relevant. And, you know, actually there's, you know, and I lived in London for a while, a few years ago. And, you know, you speak to people, and there's a lot of people who go to London to hide away, because regardless of who you are in London, it's a very different, you know, a very different way of living. People are very much, everyone's kind of the background, and people have a place to get to, or they haven't got that much time for looking at, you know, strangers and wondering who they are. And I know I got recognised a lot of times, and, you know, I have a great, you know, I have a great feeling for the gay community, especially in London, because, you know, I'm sure that I haven't been the only, you know, the only man to go into a gay bar who has been married or has a secret to hide, and I won't be. So I feel this, you know, there's, they almost showed an empathy towards me and an understanding.
You described yourself earlier, you said that it's really important to you that you know that you yourself are a decent person.
Yeah.
So how did that decent person at the time reconcile the reality that he was sleeping behind his wife's back?
By creating another character, by creating, you know, a separate person. And
But was there a sense of guilt when you...
Oh, a massive, huge.
You wake up, you know, with Gemma in the morning. And...
Oh, huge. That's right. You know, for me, again, it's like that's the chipping away effect, because literally, you know, obviously this didn't happen every day. This happened on a very, very rare occasions. But when it did happen, or even my thoughts were thinking, I didn't want to hurt everything I had created, and I didn't want to... hurt Gemma by telling her. And I thought if I could do things a better way and be a better person and maybe do things that I thought other people would want me to do, then I'd wake up one day and I wouldn't feel like this anymore, and I wouldn't have to break people's hearts and hurt other people.
How did you tell her? How do you tell your wife?
I just told her in the end. There's no other way, you know, there's no other way of doing it. You can't.
Did you sit her down? Did you arrange a time and a place?
I just went home one day. I'd been doing a rugby academy, and I just went home one day and sat her down.
And when you say those words to your wife, "I'm gay," how does she react?
There was probably more of a shock. It's a confusion, because, you know, one thing I learned as well is, you know, I've known Gemma nearly all my life. So, and it took me nearly 20 years to be able to kind of accept who I was. So for me to tell somebody this and expect them to kind of be okay with it and say, "Oh, you know what, it's fine, I'm glad you told me," it's a real selfish thing for me to think. So, you know, there was tears, there was questions.
She stayed living with you at that stage.
Yeah,
she didn't walk out.
Yeah, the thing is, we stayed together. And again, this is why I think Gemma was such a great person, because, you know, we'd been married for so long, and we'd had whatever you may think of the marriage or other people think of it, we had an amazing time together. You know, we had good times, we had bad times, just like any other marriage. And we'd been through some tough times together. So for me to just say that, and then, you know, made people just turn around and say, "Well, I would have just left." You know, it's difficult to just walk and leave everything you've created behind. And it was, you know, Gemma had to be able to come to terms with as well, because it was not like something she could fight against. It wasn't like I was sleeping with another woman. So she could turn around and say, "Well, is this something I've done? Or is this something I couldn't give you?" There was nothing that she could have done, because there was nothing that she'd done wrong. So... you know, this is not just a simple thing of, "Look, I've been cheating on you," end of. This is a life-changing thing for both of us. And it was good to be able to talk about it and have time and be able to understand where our paths go together, rather than trying to do it alone.
When she leaves you, you almost have a nervous breakdown. So you fall apart.
Yeah.
Nervous breakdowns are nearly talked about so often these days that they roll off the tip of tongues and go over people's heads.
But, yeah.
You know, what can you describe what it was for you?
Loneliness and feeling like my life was out of my control, because all of a sudden this secret that I had kept, that was mine, that was the secret to my being able to live or my wanting to die, was now in the hands of somebody else, and potentially in the hands of other people who would then potentially give it to the hands of somebody else. And therefore, you know, I felt I was no longer in control of my own destiny, really.
And you wanted it to end.
For me, it did feel like the easiest thing to do was to, as I call it, I didn't like to say die, but as I called it, I just wanted to close my eyes and never have to open them again.
What stopped you?
Maybe it's luck, maybe it's fate, I don't know, but I tried. You know, I don't know how close I was to actually doing it. I took tablets. I drank booze with the tablets. I don't know if I was one tablet away or one more drink away. I have no idea. But, you know, I'd have kind of prepared for it. I kind of dressed myself up very smartly, because I always had this imagination that, you know, if I was going to be found dead, then I'd like my parents to be proud of me. So I'd look smart.
My goodness, the most... You've just kind of hit my brain there quite hard when you say that, you know, you're painting this image of that you want to you want to kill yourself, but you want to dress well because you still want your parents to be proud of you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what we say. Is that I was in the boxing I've done.
It's very, very sad, Gareth.
It is sad, and you know, I can look back now and, you know, I don't feel sad about it. Sad is something, you know, I think when, you know, when a friend of mine gets hurt, or you know, like a relative or someone, that's sad. But you know, I felt that this was a consequence of my actions. And you know, the only thing I feel sad about when I think back to that is the sadness that I would have put other people through even more if I had actually been able to have gone through with it. And the thought then, you know, at the time I was just thinking I want my parents to be proud of me with my blazer on and my tie. But when I'm in a place now where I got some clarity and I've got some direction with my life, then I can look back and think, actually, that makes me sad to think that I would have had to see them or potentially put them through that.
So how do you get from that stage, that very lonely place, to deciding, do you know what, I'm going to tell the world and I'm going to be me?
Gemma had left me. People started finding out in certain ways. The press were camped outside my house. They were knocking on my neighbours' doors. They were going to where Gemma was living. There was, you know, vans with cameras outside. So the press, you know, were threatening to release this as a story.
It's horrible.
So, it was horrible because I wasn't ready for anybody to know. I was not ready. And if they had run the story when I wasn't ready, then I'm telling you now, I would have definitely killed myself because I wasn't ready. And it wasn't the press eventually.
That's really interesting, actually. So, you know, think about that. So, a journalist, a newspaper editor could have resulted in you killing yourself.
Oh, yeah, yeah, easily.
That's the power they had.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because that's the thing is, you know, I didn't feel it was necessary, or didn't feel like I had to publicly come out in a newspaper. I didn't feel that was the right for anybody to know. But ultimately, for me to be able to then have a life and to be able to walk down the street one day eventually hand in hand with somebody, or to go to a bar in London and to be able to not worry, then I had to, because if I didn't do it in my own words and tell my own story, then a reporter or somebody else would have done it in their words. But the thing
if they had avoided you in a newspaper, why would that have been so bad that you would have, you know, that,
because
that little boy with all those dreams and all that stuff, you would have killed yourself. Why would that have been so bad?
Because of the fact that I had got married, and because of the fact that I had lied so long to so many people. So everybody that I had lied to would have heard this story from somebody else. Yeah. I felt if I had one thing left in the world that I could do that would make me feel alive again,
it just scares,
is be honest.
It scares me, Gareth, listening to you now, how, you know, that frenzy which is a press pack, and that insatiable appetite that there is from people like me and newspaper editors and journalists. You know, it's one story to a journalist, and then once they publish it, they're on to the next one, and
exactly,
the next one. And, you know, I present shows 7 days a week, so I'm on to a story, the next one. But the aftermath for you when that journalist would have moved on to the next story, is you would have killed yourself.
Yeah,
it's just terrifying.
The thing with it is, the truth of it is that I did not come out then because of that. I can honestly, that was a part of it, but I did not come out of that is because I found somewhere from my family and my friends, I just thought, you know what, I am going to take my life in my control. That's it. It was so, you know, it wasn't the fear of them. All of us, you could say maybe it was a part, but I didn't fear being outed. I feared my life being out of my control.
I will move on from this in a second, but did you get threatening phone calls from them? Did they ring you threatening to publish anything like that?
No, what happened was they threatened a few times, but they kind of rung the union, the Welsh Rugby Union, and there was a woman working for me at the time, because it was kind of happening quite a lot, and she was like a solicitor, and she would be contacted to say that they're running with it in like kind of 24 hours kind of thing. They did it once before a Wales-England game, and I was due to play in the game And the coach pulled me and he said, look, we've been told that on the Sunday after the Wales-England game on the Saturday that they're going to out you in the paper. Do you want to play or do you want to pull out? And by that time, I'd gathered enough strength. And I remember saying to the coach, Gareth Jenkins, I said, you know what? If they out me on the Sunday, they'll out me as the winning captain of Wales beating England. And that's a bigger story than me being gay, trust me. And luckily, we won that day and they didn't run the story after.
Yeah. They were trying to bounce you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What's the feeling like then when you run out onto a rugby pitch as an openly gay player?
Well, for the first time, I was afraid because nobody in the world of rugby union professionally had come out. So all of a sudden, you know, when you're a professional sports person and you're in the arena, then you're an easy target. And if somebody has ammunition on you, then my fear was, well, will they use this ammunition to stop me performing, you know, and for me to worry. So I was obviously fearful of that, but I can honestly say 99% of the time, I had nothing but respect and nothing but credibility from fans for actually being brave enough, not only to come out, but being brave enough to come out and carry on playing and carrying on putting myself in a position of vulnerability potentially.
So if you were looking back now, that boy who you described at the beginning of this interview that had all of that imagination that we all have as children, and you and I talked about that lovely moment when you're a child where you think anything's possible. If you were looking back to yourself at 13, 14, 15 years of age, from the benefit of what you've now learned about life, what would you tell yourself?
The thing is with that is I'd love to say, there's kind of mistakes that you're going to make. But ultimately, where you'll end up, your destination, your final destination, will give so many other people strength and so many other people a reason to have a life that they thought they never could have, that everything I go through will eventually, as sadistic as it sounds, be worth it. Because every trophy I've won and, you know, every accolade I've had is amazing. But when somebody tells you that you've had an influence on their life for the positive and actually saved people's lives, then, do you know what? Every trophy you've won becomes totally irrelevant to a life that you've been able to give.
I've no doubt you probably have saved people's lives.
Yeah, many people stop me even now. Stop me on the street that I've never... And again, it's great because it's...
There'll be people listening to this just wondering if they can feel as free as you now do.
Yeah, and there's hope for everyone because, trust me, you know, I've been at the bottom of the pit and not only did I get out of it, but I managed to get out of it and then I can look back down, see where I was and be able to talk about it. And
are you happy
that takes
now?
A journey. I've never been happier. And do you know what I am now? I'm the 14-year-old kid that I always used to be. The 14-year-old kid that I always used to be. I see life as, you know, I see life as something to be enjoyed because I feel like, you know, I've put other people through a lot and I don't want to put other people through terrible things anymore. And also I've kind of travelled a journey enough in my life to know how to avoid bad situations and how to avoid chaos. So I just kind of try to keep everything simple. That way it keeps everything happy.
Yeah, you've survived. And therefore, to have survived, now you can live.
Exactly, exactly. And it's, you know, I'm the age of 40 now. And honestly, I feel like, you know, I feel like I'm 18. I'm an 18-year-old who's very, very wise.
I've really enjoyed talking to you, Gareth.
Thanks, bud.
Thank you very much for sharing your story with me.
Thank you very much.